All right, if you've listened this far, you know the deal. The book that came out of this podcast is called How the Internet Happened, From Netscape to the iPhone by me, available wherever fine books are sold. Also, the podcast I do these days is called The Tech Meme Ride Home. Search any podcast app for Ride Home, and you should find The Tech Meme Ride Home, which is all the day's tech news every weekday in just 15 minutes. If you like this show, you'll love that one.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
This episode is brought to you by ResumeWriting.com. For more than 15 years, the network of independently certified professional resume writers at ResumeWriting.com have helped hundreds of thousands of people land better jobs. Before starting your job search, go have them get you ready at www.ResumeWriting.com. Welcome to the Internet History Podcast. I'm your host, Brian McCullough. This is Chapter 5, Supplemental Episode 1. Craig Bromberg has had a long and fascinating career at the intersection of media and technology. An early adopter of online technologies, Craig was a freelance writer when he was chosen by Pathfinder head Walter Isaacson to become the first editorial director of the Pathfinder project. Craig tells us about the thinking that went into the launch of the website and the strategic goals that Pathfinder was intended to achieve. But he was also a participant in the Byzantine corporate politics that so hobbled Pathfinder's trajectory. And so he gives us a fascinating firsthand account of what it was like to fight for a specific vision inside a big organization like Time Warner. Craig has worked with media from every angle, and so the second half of the interview sees us get into a fascinating discussion about where media is and how it can succeed in the digital age. I didn't know this ahead of time, but Craig is a neighbor of mine in Brooklyn, so for the first time on this project, I was able to do a face-to-face interview. Craig was kind enough to come sit in my living room and have our discussion. So, word of warning, you do hear my daughter in the background towards the end of the interview. For that, I apologize, but only a little bit. She was quiet and happy for the better part of an hour, and that's quite a win for a three-month-old, I think. Anyway, here's the interview with Craig Bromberg. Craig Bromberg, thanks for coming on the Internet History Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start back in the, I guess, late 80s, early 90s. You're working as a freelance journalist. Is that right?
I was working as a freelance writer mostly for Vanity Fair and New York Magazine, and then decided that I really wanted to join the editorial business and get out of the freelance thing. I worked for a lot of magazines and newspapers and had reached my ceiling from my perspective, and had written a book and was ready for a managerial challenge. And so I took a job with a controlled circulation magazine that lasted about a year, and wound up at a party one night with my very glamorous then fiance, who did not become my wife, and got into a conversation with Walter Isaacson.
Well, I'm gonna interrupt you there for just a second before we jump into that story. Let's talk also about you were on Echo. Can you tell us about Echo and what Echo was?
So Echo is really interesting. It was one of the first conference network bulletin board systems. It wasn't a traditional bulletin board. It had a piece of software, Unix-based software, that basically allowed people to see different topics in conferences. So those conferences, I think on the Well, which was the West Coast variation, Whole Earth Electronic Link, the Well, Echo East Coast Hangout, these conferences could be about any number of topics. And so I was turned on to Echo by a very close friend of mine, and I was user number 11, he was number 8, and we watched this community grow from 10 people to 25 people to 50 people to 150 people to 300 to 500, and then, you know, beyond our wildest imaginations, 1,200 people. At the beginning, it was probably one of the most exciting things I've ever experienced in my life, this literal feeling of digital community in a live context where you're sitting in front of your machine and there are threaded conversations and conferences with a host and taking place at every hour of the day with live interactions between people.
And this is modem-based dial-in?
This is modem-based dial-in. There were no slip connections.
Right.
And in fact, these were, I can't even remember what the speed was, before 100, before 56K.
I was going to say like 300 or something, 1,200.
I think 300. I think I went, my first modem was a 300 baud modem with a K-Pro 2. Then I got a PC, which had a 1,200.
Right.
Then I got a 56K.
Right, right, right.
I think 56 was maybe the last one before we started going to cable or DSL.
Right.
But I, you know, it was incredibly exciting. I met many, many, many amazing people there.
Was it mostly media industry based people on there?
No, it was all sorts of people. It was fascinating. It's been started by a woman named Stacey Horn here in New York. But the West Coast thing, the Well, was started by Stuart Brand, you know, who was the founder of the Whole Earth Catalog.
Right.
And you know, the flavor of it and the wannabe characteristics of the East Coasters who wanted to be like the West Coasters.
So it had a sort of countercultural 60s sort of
absolutely
vibe. Yeah.
It was totally, you know, there, like, for example, the travel conference, which was hosted by my friend Jeremy Wolf, was called Elsewhere. I can't remember which conference I hosted. I think it might have been media. I don't remember. But, you know, there was a media conference and there was a travel and there were parenting and all sorts of conferences. And you'd have to apply. You'd have to send a note to the conference moderator to be admitted to that conference. And then there would be a topic and you'd respond to that topic in a threaded conversation mode. And it could be exhilarating because it could be very fast. And then eventually there were private messages that were added. So it wasn't all in public. Then there were private messaging and public messaging. But it was like living with 50 people. It was amazing.
So by virtue of you being an early adopter to this online community, when you're on this boat with Walter Isaacson, apparently you're espousing the wonders of online life, and he hears you? Is that what happened?
That's exactly how it was. I was talking about Echo, and Walter was said in this kind of, you know, very laconic Louisiana voice that he has. He always talks about his great aunt in Bugaloosa. Says, "So y'all know anything about that worldwide something or other?" And I didn't know that it was classic Southern rope-a-dope. And I rose to the occasion. I was like, "Are you kidding me? My friend Dan Levy called me and took me out just a few weeks ago. He showed up at my house with a slip connection." Actually, it'd been probably about 6 months earlier. And so I'd been on the first Netscape browser with a slip connection right from the very beginning and had been playing with it. And so Walter said to me, "Well, if you know something about it, let's talk." And so he had me write a memo.
This is late 93?
This is probably September of 92.
Okay.
Before 93, I think. And he had me write this memo to him, which I still have somewhere. It's called The Next Generation of Time, Inc., which, you know, is basically my attempt to say, you have to think about journalism as data. And you have to think about the internet and not just about closed gardens of communication. And Walter, to my surprise, because I knew who he was, and I'd read the Kissinger bio, and I was in awe of him as somebody who was able to both write and have an editorial career, which at that time was what I aspired to as well. And he was, he called me up, and we ended up having these conversations almost every week. And I wasn't the only person. He'd mentioned other people to me on the phone who he was talking with. But he was clearly educating himself and picking people's brains and would literally pick up the phone and call me sometimes and say with a question.
And just for the listener's benefit, so Walter Isaacson at this point is high up at Time, the Time division of Time Warner.
He was the assistant managing editor at that time. Mm-hmm. He was in the back of the book as opposed to running the entire... He wasn't the managing editor. Managing mm-hmm. editor is the highest title you can have in a timing context. So he was the assistant managing editor of Time. He was running the back of the book, which is where the letters and soft cultural stuff was. And then something interesting happened. And that was that... So Jerry Levin, who was the chairman and CEO of Time Inc., or maybe of all of Time Warner, excuse me, I think Time Warner, Don Logan was the CEO of Time Inc. Jerry Levin had this pet project that he was pursuing called the Full Service Network, which was down in Orlando, Florida. And it was being run through a combination of Silicon Graphics technology, and I guess Jim Clark plays into the story here a little bit. And the guy who was running it came out of HBO named Jeff Holmes. And it was a very splashily advertised venture and was extremely complex because it had very meticulous front-end graphics that were designed by Iconic, which was an agency out west, with what was described as a digital server, but was in reality, we heard later, was just a bunch of guys in a room moving tapes
yeah.
They tried to test it in Orlando on I don't know how many houses, how many homes, but they did
5,000. Yeah,
they did do a test, and they had some feedback from it, which I guess some of it was positive, but some of it which was not positive. And I guess to nobody's astonishment, Holmes was out. And Isaacson was asked to take his place, not running the Full Service Network, but running this thing which was going to be called Time Inc.
New Media,
I think. Maybe. Mm-hmm. That's mm-hmm. right. Time Inc. New Media. And it was not internet-based. It was just an exploratory thing. And
there
was
anything digital.
Anything. We didn't even think of it as digital. We mm-hmm. called it online.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And so Walter convened this group of people, which was Oliver Knowlton, who was then doing ops, editorial operations for Time Magazine. Bruce Judson, who was a kind of smart young troubleshooter with a double J DMBA.
Kurt
Vibrantz, who mm-hmm. was the president of HBO.
Michael Wolff was in there.
Michael Wolff mm-hmm. was in there for a little bit. And then one day Walter called me up and said, we've gotten rid of Wolf. He was a pain in the ass. come and talk to me about working up here. And so they hired me with some amorphous title. I think it was some coordinator of Time Inc. New Media, editorial coordinator.
Editorial, right.
That's what it was. And so I was hired in this sort of lowly position and mostly just left to sort of figure it out. How do we do something?
That's kind of a question that I have. There's not really a mission statement for this group other than let's just go in another direction. FSN might be winding down, but we still think this is the future. So what's out there?
Right. And so, there were a couple of options, right? We knew that there was stuff going on in AOL, but I was, as I said, already on the internet. I was already using the Mosaic browser. I was extremely excited by the idea that somehow or other, we were going to take timing content and move it into this realm of the internet. We didn't even know what that really meant, to be honest. We had no concept of what servers were. We didn't understand what HTML was. We didn't know how to deal with Unix or how to deal with Perl. We had no concept of any of these things, and it was basically left to me to figure it out, because nobody else knew. And even though my technical knowledge was relatively limited, I went out there and started searching for people. And so I found a guy named Mark Jason Dominus, who was at the University of Pennsylvania. And he was already then one of the top experts on Perl. And he set up a server for us with a guy named Shad Todd. And the three of us basically started programming this environment. And we did a very early homepage, which...
And you're doing it for the web at this point, or you're just doing it maybe with the idea of doing a dial-up service, or...
We were doing it strictly for the web, and meanwhile, at the same time, there were these high-level strategic discussions that were taking place. So Walter, you know, would communicate with Logan and, I guess, with Jerry Levin, and one of the things that came down the pipe was discuss MCI. There was an opportunity to work very closely with MCI. I believe that Walter might have had a family connection to MCI. So that was a long discussion. I remember sitting at some very, very long boardroom tables with top MCI brass and feeling like, you know, this was interesting. There was the same discussions with AT&T, I remember as well. But mostly we were just out to sort of figure out how to program material from Time Inc. magazines into this this very tiny little website. It was, there were a lot of different strategic perspectives that one could take, and it was you know, a lot of, there was a lot of fighting in a small room, and the fighting became quickly more intense when I think in my third or fourth week, or maybe a couple months into doing this, Dick Duncan, who was the another assistant managing editor or executive editor of Time magazine, who was running the Time on AOL venture, heard about me and was aghast. And I'll never forget being led into Dick Duncan's office by Isaacson. He said, "Well, I'm going to have to take you in there. You're going to have to meet these guys." And walking in, and Isaacson saying, "This is the guy." And Duncan sitting behind his desk, his whole room just stinking of cigars. Because in those days you could smoke in the office. And looking at his face getting redder and redder, and because he had had a guy who was working for him and running the Time on AOL, whatever you want to call it, portal. And that guy was named Jim Kinsella. And Kinsella was, you know, probably about the same age as I am, but he'd already had a entrepreneurial experience. And he was just a supremely confident manager. Really terrific, sharp-minded guy. And he had been told that if there was ever an opportunity, Time magazine would be the one to rule the roost. And so this battle very quickly erupted between Time magazine as the crown jewel of Time's assets and what a Time Inc. venture would be. And so we had this many months long standoff where our competing visions of the future were debated.
Well, and the web wins out I get the impression the web wins out because even though the partnership with AOL was first, and that was hugely important for AOL at the time to get time, you know, on their site and things like that. But isn't it that Time Warner is a little suspicious of AOL's motive, maybe? Or
I think the web won out really quickly. I don't think that was the issue. In fact, the meetings with AT&T and MCI were really about whether we should do a proprietary network, and to potentially compete against AOL.
The question I'm getting at, though, the strategic idea is if you go to the web, then there's no middleman. You're doing it directly to the consumer. Like, that maybe is an attractive strategic consideration. Because creating something with AT&T is, again, all right, we're cutting AOL out of the system. We'll just do our own.
Right. But I don't think that the issues around AT&T and MCI and those kinds of telecom collaborations, were so much about the lost revenue to AOL, because the audience was already clearly important. That's why the revenue was a good stand. It wasn't just a loss leader. The real debate was really about what capabilities you could develop and what relationship to customers you could have and who those customers were.
Is there thinking maybe that if we do our own dial-up service, then we can do the subscription model right away?
There was a lot of talk about subscription, but again, the question was, where do you see the strategic focus in 5 years, in 10 years? So it quickly became apparent that creating another walled garden was not going to lead to the kind of audience development or scale that would be significant enough to move the needle. Mm-hmm. I think that was more based on intuition. It was not like, I mean, we didn't have at that point McKinsey guys running around yet. We had some rudimentary research. We were working with Iconic. We had business plans. We had meetings. But there was no real, at least not at the operational level, any real strategic nuos that was being circulated. There was a guess. And the guess was that this internet thing, this web thing, because that's what it kept being called, was going to gather speed and momentum. And the question really was, what entity should it be? And so there were really two competing perspectives. You know, my perspective was that Time Inc. had amazing assets and resources, and that customers, and by customers I meant end users, had the desire to understand and search subjects, and that the data, the articles, were the gold. That we weren't going to build more credibility for the individual brands unless we went and committed vast resources to building entities for each brand. And so my cheap, low-key perspective was that we could create a brand of Time Inc. And so that was one perspective, that there would be this almost like a curated version of Time Inc.
And so, and that goes under the Pathfinder banner?
No, actually, that was being touted as Calliope.
Okay.
That was my code name for it. And we went very far down the path of debating this, what I called centripetal perspective. Versus a centrifugal perspective, right, where everything was being spun into a center, and then so then you'd spin it back out essentially to the titles. So there were these two perspectives. Kinsella's perspective was that no, we needed to create a very minimal entity at the center of all this, and basically become a service organization to help titles build brand. And so that was the two perspectives. And Isaacson heard us and one day sat us down in his office and said, "So you both have interesting ideas. I don't know who's the better one. I'm going to give you both some time and money and go out and build your model." Now, Jim Kinsella is one of the smartest people I've met my entire career. I mean, he's now the chairman of Interroute. It's one of the largest cable companies in Europe. He's absolutely brilliant. And he knew the ropes. And he knew how to generate. He'd been an entrepreneur. He had a business as an ergonomics business while he was in college at Swarthmore. And he'd managed to recognize that he really wanted to be in the design of media instead of the design of objects, industrial design. And so he'd wound up at Time Inc. And he was damned if he was going to let somebody else get in front of him. And he commanded resources that, you know, made my head spin. He had Janet Weigel, who was Time's designer. He had writers and editors he was working with. And he had all those people at his disposal. Me, I had only the organization that I had created, which was very, very few people. I mean, maybe three or four people. And I hired Lucy Sisman, who Oliver Knowlton had suggested that I hire because they're related. It's Oliver's ex-sister-in-law, I think. So Oliver suggested Lucy, who's one of the greatest graphic designers, magazine designers ever. And so Lucy and I worked together on something, and Janet worked with Jim. And, you know, our competing visions of the world came to a head, and Walter basically made Jim the managing editor of this thing. And me, I had a kind of undefined role. Jim couldn't figure out what that was. He basically said I was the deputy editor. Mm-hmm. But there were no formal titles really at that point because there weren't very many people. And Jim wasn't going to be able to push me out the door right away.
Right, so you lose the bake-off, but you don't necessarily walk away.
Well, Jim, I think, had basically been told, give him a year. And so that's probably pretty much what it was. I think it was probably a little more than a year. And it just, you know, that was a tough time for me. I mean, I learned, Jim was trying to put his stamp on this evolving entity, which, you know, was Pathfinder. Mm-hmm. And got to be called Pathfinder. And it was just a truly amazing and bumpy ride as we tried to figure out, you know, what resources could we command as these curated entities, and which could we service or send out, farm out, as service entities to those titles who were most interested in. And then what could we do to explore the nether world of, because this was Jerry Levin's project and not just a Time Inc. project, what could we do in the Warner Brothers world? Mm-hmm. So it kind of came to me, basically Jim said, look, I'm only interested in Time and people and the crown jewels. Mm-hmm. You can go and you can deal with, actually, he gave me people. I think he was more interested in SI. You can deal with anything that has to do with culture. People, Entertainment Weekly, Warner Brothers, corral as many as you can. Bring them to the thing. And then create entities. You know, you have to pass it by me. You have to have a budget. You got to do all this stuff, but figure out what to do. So I don't remember the first one. I mean, I remember one of them was called Digital Pulse. I hired Steve Baldwin, who was a car writer, to work on that, along with Chris Peacock. And those guys ran down that way. Another one of our editors was a guy named Steve Mitra, and he started doing stuff on the homepage. Jim hired a guy named Michael Perhaes, who came actually out of creating signage. Highway signage, and now he's designing on the pixel level. And there was a small art department, and you know, at that point, for almost 8 months or 10 months, I'd been running the whatever you want to call it, Pathfinder homepage, basically, figuring out headlines, the relationship to stories, and this thing. But this entity of the homepage became hotly debated because, you know, what was it? What was its intent? Was it its intent to drive you to these other sources, or was it its intent to pull you in?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I think that that debate
Was it ever really settled?
Never got settled.
Yeah.
It was a constant battle. I think it got settled when Jim finally pushed me out, and then shortly after was pushed out himself.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there was a mess the last 5 months of before Linda McCutcheon and Dan Okren took over. It was just a messy time. But the debate was healthy, I think, actually, because the reality is that, well, at least I learned a tremendous amount from it. And what I learned was that, you know, the internet is, you know, people say about Pathfinder that, and I think you said in your broadcast earlier, that Time Inc. didn't get that the internet was sui generis, and they kept thinking of it as a medium that they could push their stuff through. And I think that there's some truth to that. But I also think that some of us did recognize that there was an opportunity not to just recirculate and aggregate, but actually to curate the news in a different way and create a freestanding entity. So for me, that was always what Calliope/Pathfinder was always supposed to be. I just saw it as a kind of native internet product that would never be, you know, I wasn't concerned, frankly, at that point with revenue.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't looking for advertising money. We weren't thinking that this was a great way to build audience. What I wanted to do was create a beachhead for Time Inc. or Time Warner on the internet that people could explore our products, but by actually tasting them first.
Mm-hmm.
And those little tastes would take them into deeper territory. And the magazines we'd give service capabilities to, and they would have their own sites. But there would be this place that, very much like Salon or Slate, that had some of its own entities, but also aggregated and curated resources from around Time Inc.
So I'd like to ask you about like some of the components, and if some of these things were launched after you left, you can let me know. But because this is basically, this site doesn't exist anymore. Like, you can't find. So what did it launch with? It launches with, it's the homepage, and it's pointing to various properties for Sports Illustrated, for this and that and the other thing. Was there a login system? Did you become a member? Did you register?
There was no registration. There was no onboarding. None of the concepts of paywall that we have presently existed.
But wasn't there a push to do some sort of a subscription? Because I've read that there was a deadline. We're gonna start charging at this date, and then they let it slide because they wanted more numbers.
Not during my tenure.
Okay.
That may have come during Linda's tenure.
Okay.
And Linda and Dan. But in the early days, we were not concerned about revenue. We were concerned about entity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's one of the things that's, you know, kind of interesting is that Don Logan's famous thing that Pathfinder was the black hole. Sucking hole of Time Inc. It really comes around the McCutcheon-Okren era.
Okay.
It's not around the era that we...
Not around the 94, it's more 95, 96.
I really think, if I remember correctly, that's when it happens. And, you know, I think that people don't really understand the fluidity of the debate that was going on inside, that Isaacson really had fomented,
mm-hmm.
which was, you know, what is this entity?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was a philosophical debate going on about, and maybe too philosophical,
mm-hmm.
about what this thing should be.
What about things like bulletin boards, chat, email, anything like that?
So, you know, again, how much resources should be allocated to the federal entity and how much to the states?
Mm-hmm.
I think the same argument is very similar. The federal entity could only do certain things that the states would never be able to do. the states can't do a bulletin board. Mm-hmm. And then it becomes, by the way...
So the states can't do it, only the government can do the bulletin
correct.
Board. So an individual, Sports Illustrated wasn't allowed to have bulletin board.
It wasn't a question, it wasn't allowed. Mm-hmm. It was a question of didn't have the resource.
Right, okay.
And so who could do it? So we came up with Wabbit, which was mm-hmm. Walter's alternate bulletin board internet threads. That was my title for it.
Mm-hmm.
Wabbit was a great, very much like Echo, because that was where I came from. And mm-hmm. I believed mm-hmm. in the power of threaded conversations. And AOL certainly had its own threaded conversation boards, but it was a very different kind of bulletin board system. And it was also not internet-based. It was AOL's Rain Man, or
right,
Rainmaker,
right.
was the software. That
Rain something, yeah.
Right, say Rain, I think it was Rainmaker. I can't remember. And, you know, from my perspective, there were data assets that had to be unlocked. And the data assets lied all over Time Inc. So, you know, one of the things that, all over Time Warner. So, you know, one of the projects that I was pursuing, especially in the last 8 months of my tenure, were, well, wait a minute. There's book reviews at People, mm-hmm. Time, Entertainment Weekly, even Sports Illustrated had book reviews. We've got an e-commerce capability in Book of the Month Club.
Mm-hmm.
Let's tie it all together.
Mm-hmm.
Let's use those assets to, again, create a curated entity, but here with an e-commerce capability. Oh, and there's this guy in Seattle. Have you heard about
right,
him? He's
right.
an ex-banker named Jim Bezos. What's his name? And we're all like, you know, clamoring over what the potential there could be. And that's a whole nother story. I don't want to take over this segment with that. But essentially, then I bring the Four Horsemen of the Aged Apocalypse, Sam Cohn, Woody Allen's agent, Jason Epstein, the literary dynamo. I can't remember this two other guys' name. One guy who had basically been the producer of the Ed Sullivan Show, who had actually started with the idea of creating a cable channel about ecology and green things,
mm-hmm.
and couldn't get the financing, and then stumbled on the idea of doing a book channel,
mm-hmm.
And my then girlfriend was a novelist and was writing at NYU or teaching at NYU, and so that put me in touch with Ed Doctorow, Yale Doctorow, and he had somehow become part of the investor group around this thing when they decided to do a book channel,
mm-hmm.
and they called it Book TV.
Hmm.
And so one by one, I had these guys come to my little office on the 40th floor at Time Inc. and see the World Wide Web.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Epstein's first exposure to it, Sam Cohn's first exposure to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they came up and they saw and they were believers.
Mm-hmm.
And I started having these conversations about how we could actually work together on this thing. And as I left Time Inc., I actually continued focusing on building a business plan. It was the first business plan I ever wrote.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked with Iconic on it to create what was going to be called BookNet, because they weren't finding cable carriage
mm-hmm.
from Time Warner Cable.
And so it would be a website that would be book community.
It would have been book community. I wanted to do book e-commerce.
Uh-huh, right.
Book editorial. I mean, the ironic thing is that Disney then picks me up right after working at Time and hires me to start a book magazine called Book City, then called Books First, that would have been a national mainstream magazine about books and authors using Doubleday Direct, which at that time was much bigger than Book of the Month Club, as an e-commerce and direct mail partner. And so that relationship then grew and grew and grew. And bizarrely, then timing comes back into the story, because when CNN and Sports Illustrated tied up as a result of the Turner marriage with Time Warner, suddenly Disney gets cold feet on all of the properties except that fledgling ESPN. And then all resources go to ESPN, and I'm left without a horse in the game. But to come back to Time Warner, you know, that was among the most ambitious plans that we had. You know, I tried to do things on a much smaller basis in terms of sort of curated editorial entities. So, for example, we did the Digital Pulse thing. We did OJ Central, which was the OJ case. And that ended up probably right around the time when I left Time Inc., because I know, because I had actually prepared the not guilty and guilty pages.
Okay, wait, so you're the one responsible for that?
No, I was not. Okay. I had left, and Jim pushed the guilty page out, not me. And maybe it wasn't Jim himself.
Maybe it was
one of the art directors. I was out of the building. Literally out of the building. I was no longer a Time Inc. employee. But I was the one who came up with the idea of a calendar where every day you could click on a hotspot to see what had happened in the trial. Again, how could you bring Time Inc. resources to these magazine-like properties that weren't owned by the titles, but would bring readers to the titles, because there was an interesting perspective about the news.
So I'm curious, what sort of uptick did you see? Like, how did community community gain traction? We know OJ Central had some traction, but like in general, like did these bulletin boards take off and start to foster
they
communities?
They weren't bulletin boards, first of all.
Okay, message boards.
Boards. They were editorial entities. They were curated editorial entities. Digital Pulse had Mitra and Chris Peacock behind it, and Steve Baldwin, and they were generating copy, but they were really curators, and their job was very curatorial in nature. But they're curating from Time Inc. And the problem is that, you know, the resources that were inside those different entities were extremely limited. So they didn't have their current issues in a digital format that was usable. They were locked up inside publishing systems that were they were digital publishing systems, but you'd have to actually like copy and paste the text.
So that's an interesting question I want to ask. So is it mostly for the stuff you're doing online, is it completely new editorial stuff? It's not just taking last week's issue and throwing those articles up? Or is it a mix of that? Or?
It's a blend. I mean, Pathfinder was a blend of that stuff. And again, the tussle or the argument or the debate, depending upon what moment you're talking about, between our different perspectives at that time is very much about how much of this stuff is we taking from Time Magazine, from People Magazine, from EW, and actually copying and pasting into our publishing system, into the HTML publishing system. And it was literally copying and pasting. We would get files that were sent by email that we would copy and paste, or they would give us a disk, and we would take the disk and copy and paste.
There's no content management systems at this point.
No, it didn't
yet.
Exist. I mean, it wasn't there.
Right.
And we taught ourselves HTML. CSS didn't even exist.
Right.
There were no style sheets.
Right.
We were among the people who were at the cusp of inventing style sheets. In fact, it was when people like Andrew Anker from Wired came to us and said, hey, do you know about style sheets? That we were hip to the idea that there were technologies that could actually simplify the process. So much of our effort was about understanding the very, very, very rudimentary aspects of what was a link, how a link could be found, how you could alert people. We wanted to have relationships with Yahoo, because Yahoo was, in our opinion, the gold standard.
And they were coming in taking meetings at this point, right?
They were. I mean, they were. But again, most of our attention was focused not on the Yahoos of the world, because Yahoo was very insular and California-based. They were out there, I think, in Sunnyvale, right, from the very beginning. And, you know, we needed them to show that we existed. Right? That was the findability from a browsing perspective, that we could be found.
Right.
It wasn't the Google manifesto of all the world's information. Mm-hmm. Google was, you know, we might have even been shown Google. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't have registered for us because it was a far-fetched concept. Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
You had said something earlier about how, you know, you at the beginning, it's not about revenue. Like, you personally and other people are okay with losing money and things like that.
We weren't okay with losing money,
but
we just weren't. We weren't focused. We were focused on understanding what the medium was first,
and then finding
and then finding revenue.
It occurs to me that, you know, maybe one of the problems here is that it inside Time Warner, you weren't allowed the sort of entrepreneurial space, you know, because, you know, Yahoo is almost happening at the exact same time that Pathfinder's happening, like literally the exact same time. But they have the luxury of taking $100 million from SoftBank. So whatever, you know, the pressure on them to go green is not immediate. And then they have an IPO. You guys don't have that luxury because you're a section of a division. There's P&L for that division. And all you guys can show is red.
That's absolutely true. But there's another thing that I think is more critical, which is that we're a media company. We're not a digital resource. People out west had no interest in media. The Valley was not interested in what we were doing. There were technology-based reporting entities like Wired. And they saw themselves as partnering to technology and to innovation, not to media. Mm-hmm. Time Inc. specifically, not Time Warner so much, but Time Inc. specifically, has had, from the very start of its history, an essential confusion and debate about who it was really serving. Brit Haddon wanted Time Magazine and Life Magazine, which was a considerably later invention, to be very focused on a kind of literary vision of America. Luce didn't want him to screw it up, especially for advertisers. And it was Luce who moved them to Ohio, and it was Luce who found the national advertisers that were able to float the company. He didn't want Brit Haddon messing up, who's buried, by the way, right here in Greenwood Cemetery, messing things up. There's a great book called The Man Who Time Forgot, which is kind of amazing reading to understand the history of the company. And the truth of the matter is that, you know, this notion of church and state grew up to protect not journalism, but advertisers.
Mm-hmm.
I think is one of the most important things to remember, is that church and state was so that those idiots who are doing editorial wouldn't screw things up with...
It's plausible deniability. Don't worry about that controversial article. We have nothing to do with it. We still have our relationship.
That's where the money is. So this notion of a Chinese wall, of the separation of church and state, is baked into the DNA of a media company, especially into the DNA of Time Inc. And you can't change that DNA. Even today, the company is struggling with it.
And are you suggesting that almost to succeed online, there needs to be, a la BuzzFeed, all of these new media companies that are willing to completely blur that church and state line?
So what I think is that media companies have to ask themselves how to create service to readers, to users. And service is a very difficult thing to get a grip on. Because when we think about information and information goods, it's very difficult to ascertain their value, except in professional contexts, right? If you're a dentist and I sell you a dental publication because you want to learn the latest techniques for filling a tooth, it has a very specific value to you. But if you're a consumer and you're reading an article about popsicles as it's summertime, and you've got access to a commodified core of data sets that basically says there are 50 articles about popsicles in summertime, the value of that information is the value of a commodity, and it's only run, and it only economic value comes from the advertising that can be sold against it, which in the case of popsicles in summertime is very, very low, especially in a programmatic environment. So you're left with a media business that basically is commoditized at its core. Except in those upper reaches where you have premium content that has meaning for a specific audience. So if we're ever to actually figure out the future of media and the future of why this history is important, the history of the internet, is really because we actually are understanding how to disentangle the DNA that Time Inc. Constructed from the very beginning, so that we can understand what the utility is, not to advertisers, but to humans. And when we start to do that really hard work, we start to come in touch with the actual touch points of where different types of content are most important to people in their lives. And then we can see what time of day it's important to them and what relevance it has to them based on what they're doing and all of that. And there are pieces of this that are touched in what's becoming known as content marketing, but most content marketing is not thinking about consumer use cases. It's thinking about publishers' need to create reach, which puts you right back in the advertising game. And so, you know, this shows you how hard it is to actually think consumer first, user first. Because right now, you've got these entangled customer segments. Who are we working for? The advertiser or the reader? Because it's not true that their purposes are aligned. So this is where the same issues, I think, are pervasive in all media companies from Pathfinder to the present. At AOL, the same stuff is still debated. So, for example, Tim Armstrong is working extra special hard to create premium inventory that's not going to be affected by the programmatic sales of the vast amounts of crap that he knows he needs to have the pipes lubed up because he's got millions of people looking at the site. So, you know, that's so they've got a stream of revenue from programmatic sales, but they have a stream of sales from Project Devil. And the sales from Project Devil command a much higher CPM. And so, of course, he wants more of his business to be in that area, right? But it's very hard because that's content creation and content generation, and it's got to be of a much higher quality level than the same curated stuff that is the flotsam and jetsam of every Tom, Dick, and Harry media outlet.
Right.
So this is the issue, is, you know, how you make money, how you actually come to an idea of what premium content is, what good content is, and who it's for and why. And those are the essential issues that are at the core of all this stuff. They haven't changed dramatically since 1994.
To wrap it up, one of the points of this chapter in particular is to try to give a little bit of credit to Pathfinder for being pioneering, especially because it seems to have completely gone down the memory hole. But like I said, I mean, you guys, Pathfinder is doing stuff at the same time as Yahoo, a year before the Netscape IPO, you know, before the web really, really takes off. And yet, there's this weird paradox that we're talking about. Of all the media companies, why was it Time Warner that was doing this stuff at this time? Why were they the ones...
Well, I don't think that's that confusing. I mean, you know, it's... I mean, look, Jerry Levin wanted to create the 500-lane superhighway. That was his vision. And he was far out ahead of all media leaders. I mean, if you've gone down the road to Hearst or Condé, they would have, like, laughed. That's ridiculous. You know, Jerry Levin, who's, you know, had a very troubled tenure and has had a, you know, some tough times in life. You know, he was a taciturn guy who found himself in a boatload of trouble with this stuff. And, you know, I give him a lot of credit for actually recognizing that there was real opportunity to create a digital entity out of Time Warner.
So you would put a lot of credit that just on his vision for that, for... Technology would be a thing that because, again,
it was on the map. You know, mm-hmm. Look, I mean, Dow Jones was on the map also. Mm-hmm. You know, there were people Dow Jones who had Telerate, for example, who were doing some important stuff at the same time. But the New York Times was nowhere, mm-hmm. for example. And, you know, you couldn't have a meaningful conversation about this stuff because, frankly, you'd be laughed out of the office if you said, people are going to pay for stuff on the web. You could have paywalls. Advertisers would find branded content a significant way. These would be farcical suggestions in the mid-90s. But, or even the idea that content created online, articles out of curated material, could be stronger and more interesting and better experiences than straight pieces of writing, people would think you were nuts, especially if you were Time Magazine. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of gives you some insight into, you know, what the argument was inside Pathfinder. Could you really innovate and create something that was more premium and more value to people than what was in the magazine? And wouldn't mm-hmm. that threaten the magazine? Cannibalization.
Right.
That was the big red herring. You know, and some of us thought these things could coexist. That the small entity that could have been, my perspective, it's just, mm-hmm. you know, I think Jim and I have made our peace a long time ago, and I think we both agree that, you know, that small entity that was Pathfinder could do curated stuff that would have been of high value, and you could have serviced those other, the significant entities that were part of Time Inc. And I just want to say, we give short shrift to the idea that servicing is an important activity. But if you think about it, that's a significant innovation capability that was being spread through a very hierarchically driven organization.
And by servicing, you mean?
Literally giving the tools of, you know, here's how you build a website. Here's what HTML is. Here's what you can get out of this. Let's see. So Atlantic Records, what could we do to help you? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, one of the things that I did at Pathfinder that I'm most proud of was I worked on the very first major Hollywood movie promotion.
Batman Forever.
Yeah. It was huge. And, you know, it was a game. Don Buckley, who's EVP of digital at Showtime, you know, and I did it together. And, you know, was cobbling together resources, coming up with games, showing clips from the movie, WAV files, mm-hmm. you know, all in. Now, we take that for granted today, so much so that we call it, you know, electronic press kits, right? EPKs. It was basically what it was, except it was consumer facing. It wasn't just an EPK. It was really, you know, a game, you know, that you could play with clips in mind, and touch a touch something on the screen, and I feel what they call those things that we had, maps.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you touch a point on the map,
right?
And it would be,
of the image,
right?
The image
maps.
Yeah,
that's what they were.
Yep, mm-hmm.
And you define the image areas,
right?
Right. But, you know, that was the kind.
I haven't thought about that in a long time.
But that was what we were doing.
Yeah,
and it was like, it ain't journalism.
Mm-hmm.
Why is this in the same boat as Time Magazine? You're polluting the water.
Mm.
And then you want this thing, this monstrosity, to be competing on the homepage with mm-hmm. a piece of important news?
Right.
Like, you're demeaning and cheapening the property.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what's the property?
Mm-hmm.
Is it a brand of Time Inc., Time Warner, an individual brand? And this is why Pathfinder was always biting its own tail, because it was threatening to the very core entities on a cultural and brand level.
Mm-hmm.
So I know you know, one thing people talk about all the time is the revenues that you'd be getting out of AOL. Well, that's true, but the more frightening piece of this was how, what are you going to do to the brand? If this thing grows as much as you guys say it is, we're in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And Warner Brothers will just take us over. And then what'll happen to Time Inc.?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that that was an incredibly fearful perspective. And one of the things that we saw was tremendous pushback from Warner and from Time Inc. about, you know, Time Warner didn't really exist. So there were a lot of complicated things. And to be in the front line of that with all these big suits around who were drawing, you know, God knows, $350,000 paychecks. And, you know, there we were, just minions, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
I know for me it was a thrilling and frightening ride. To give you just some sense of contrast, when I went to Disney 6 weeks after leaving Time, Jake Weinbaum, who was running Disney Online, basically said, you know what, we're not going to have that problem. We're just going to give every title $100,000. And your job is to just figure out, you know, who they can partner with, and they can do anything they want. You know, you'll provide best services, you know, best practices, knowledge, and your job is to consult and help them figure it out. But, you know, here's $100,000. You're on mm-hmm. your own next year.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, immediately says the focus has to be on innovating as media properties. And, you know, you've got a sink or swim attitude. We're not going to push you out of business if your website's not going to work. You're just going to have to figure it out yourself, and you're on your own. So you better do a good job and try to make it an experience that draws advertising a little, but more important, draw a subscription.
Better model that?
I think it was a better model. Mm-hmm. I think it was a significantly less expensive and more focused, and allowed us to have greater title specificity. There were only six titles, granted, within Disney publishing. But, you know, there was an opportunity for Disney at that moment to kind of say, all right, we're gonna figure this out. And Jake also had his Waterloo with family.com.
Mm.
But that's a whole other story.
Yeah, yeah.
It's another hour.
If I could impose on you for one more thing before
yeah, yeah.
we go.
We could talk about Bertelsmann, Disney, Ziff, Samsung, Citibank.
Well, I don't know. Maybe you'll be coming back. but apparently, back in your journalism days, before all this again, you did, maybe in 93, a New York Times Magazine interview with Mark Andreessen.
It was just, Andreessen was just a source in a larger piece about the founding of Electronic Frontier, right? EFF.
Okay. Right.
Right.
Frontier Foundation.
It's been so long. Mm-hmm. I know
mm-hmm.
it's still in existence.
Mm-hmm.
The Times hired me to, Jim Atlas, who was my editor at the Times, James Atlas, who's an amazing journalist and publisher, hired me to go out and do whatever I could to figure out what was going on with this Electronic Frontier Foundation. The idea was that civil liberties were being threatened, so I went out and hung out with Mitch Kapoor, who was the founder of Lotus, and John Perry Barlow, who was an amazing dude who's a songwriter for the Grateful Dead, right. One of the first users of the Well, a Republican rancher.
Sort of from this era, there were these guys that were gurus of technology is going to transform our lives.
Absolutely.
This is the milieu that Wired came out of, kind of.
And Tim Leary, you know, mm-hmm. who definitely Barlow was close with, you know, and they all had LSD as a touchstone in their lives. And so Barlow and Kapoor had this idea that they were going to create the EFF, and Mitch suggested that we hop on his Bombardier jet and go and look at the Hackers Conference, which I think I went to the second Hackers Conference, I think it was in Tahoe, mm-hmm. and we flew in there, and then Mitch said we should go to Comdex, and we went to Comdex, and then we flew up to the Valley. I may have had the route mm-hmm, wrong. Mm-hmm. At Comdex, I met Bill Gates, and it was kind of amazing to see him in person. I didn't realize how small he was. Mm-hmm. And he was sort of small, sandy, and squeaky voice. Mm-hmm. And then we flew up to the Valley, and I'm not sure whether it was before or after the Hackers Conference, and went to see Steve Jobs at Next. Mm-hmm. Barlow really had it in for Jobs because he thought he'd betrayed Apple. There was a little bit of tension as Jobs gave us a demo of the Next machine, which was kind of amazing. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Some pointed questions were flying around. It was pretty tense.
They're all in this article?
Well, no. I mean, what was in the article was talking about what the EFF is and what the issues were. Anyway, along there, somewhere in that same trip, I went and paid a visit to Andreessen, who uh-huh. was at Netscape, uh-huh. Or Mosaic, I think it was called.
So he's out in California at this time.
Yeah, he was out in California. Okay. And he was, I mean, I didn't know what Asperger's was, but he was, you know, speaking really fast like this, in like kind of bursts. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I interviewed him about what he thought the future of the web was, and he kept coming back to this one point, which, you know, just kind of, I just didn't make any sense to me. And I came back and told Isaacson, who I was having those conversations with, because I was a writer at the time. Mm-hmm. And I said, he kept talking about cable TV. All he wanted to talk about was cable TV. He didn't want to talk about the web. He just wanted to talk about how this thing, this browser, was going to overtake cable television. And that's all he wanted to talk about. Everything I said, he kept coming back to cable TV, and cable TV is never going to be able to do this. And we're going to push out cable TV. And I was like, what does this have to do with anything? I can't figure this guy out. I mean, why aren't we talking about the quality of the images or the integration of the text in images or, like, you know, because those were things that I was concerned about because I was concerned about the design capabilities of the web. And HTML2 mm-hmm. was horrible to look mm-hmm. at, mm-hmm. right? And so, you know, that was, you know, and this guy's talking about TV and the business models of cable television and how this thing is going to overtake them one day. And I think that, you know, it obviously that's what he was thinking about. And I think we look at it today and we understand that we're getting closer to that moment as IPTV becomes increasingly relevant and the relationship of IPTV to what takes place on different devices is growing more central. You know, my kids don't like to watch television with commercials.
Right.
And they only watch IPTV. That's all they watch.
Yeah.
And they just don't like commercials. They're not interested in them. They find it clutters the experience. They'd rather pay for a subscription for the content they want. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they are happy to consume it on different devices and different times. But the living room is still the living room. And, you know, if you can control the living room, most of the other devices will follow suit. And I think whether Mark got that piece of the interconnectedness of devices or not, and I suspect that that was not what was on his bandwidth. I think what he was really thinking about was how greater bandwidth was eventually just going to, you know, take the signal that was taking place online and move it to the television as bandwidth increased. I think that's primarily where his head was at. But I think that, you know, the reality is that he was actually talking about this, how many years is it back to 1993? You know, 30 years before anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
He's been there on the front line of that and understands the business issues of these things probably better than anybody else.
Well, only 20 years, although if
is
it
that
was
20 or 30?
If it was 30, we'd all be a lot older than you.
Yeah, 20 years, right.
Because what we're talking about, Pathfinder, that's exactly 20 years ago right now.
Exactly 20 years ago,
yeah.
Well, it feels like 30.
Yeah.
It really does feel like a different era, a different time and place. I know I'm different.
Yeah, definitely. Well, Craig, I don't want to take up any more of your time, and this has been a fantastic conversation. And so thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I hope you'll edit this down.
Probably not, but trust me, people like it. Don't worry.
Okay.
Thanks. If you're enjoying this podcast, there's one simple thing that you can do to help us out. If you do nothing else, just go to iTunes and rate us. 1 to 5 stars takes about 2 seconds. Or give us a review, because the weird way that iTunes works is it's not just the number of downloads, it's also the number of ratings and reviews. As always, you can join the conversation at www.internethistorypodcast.com. Get more info, see pictures, and see my full bibliography for each episode. The show's Twitter is @NetHistoryPod, and my personal Twitter is @BrianMCC. Thanks for listening.